So John is taking a look at Genesis 1 through 4, and he's saying God has been preaching to us the gospel the whole time. And this is what that is. So we were talking on Sunday, and we've said on this podcast that, you know, Jesus is not the solution to Adam's problem. Adam is the problem to Jesus' solution. So that once we've encountered the gospel, then Adam, the story about Adam becomes a preparation for redemption through one individual. Right? The story of Adam is crafted as the downfall of humankind through one individual. That's really where it's getting us.
Welcome, everyone, to the Faith Recovery Podcast.
And I'm Nathan.
And we're seeking to recover faith by recovering the faith. We're in a series called Redefining Faith. We're like redefining the faith.
Wow, here, Nathan. The power we have.
And our episode today is entitled Working for the Weekend. Yeah. Everybody's working for the weekend.
All right.
And today, you know, we're going to talk about the Genesis accounts of creation. What do they mean? And we're going to seek to dismantle a misconception that we must interpret them literally and erect in its place something more robust. Okay?
All right.
Sound good?
Okay.
Where do you want to start with that? Genesis chapter 1?
I guess so, yeah.
In Genesis chapter 1, it seems like God created everything in 6 24-hour periods.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And humanity originated in the Middle East from 2 supernaturally created individuals.
Yes.
That's the, shall we say, misconception?
Right, yeah.
We're going back to maybe a previous episode here by saying this is what it may seem on the surface as in an unsophisticated reading. But there's a more sophisticated reading because the Bible is an ancient piece of literature, so there's, which requires a more sort of thoughtful, sophisticated reading. And at a deeper level, the Bible maybe has something theological to say to us that maybe it doesn't lie right on the surface,
or it didn't,
or a plain sense literal reading.
Maybe it didn't, and that's what we're saying is not that the Bible is only for scholars, or that you know there's only just a few people who have insight into it, and of course we are among those people, but that the gospel has to be the code key to unlock the divine transcendent intention. So we would say that the writers of the Bible were time-bound people writing out of their context from their own background. Mm-hmm. And
writing from within their context.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. And we kind of made the analogy of a bunch of people painting on a canvas, and they say this canvas is, 100 yards by 100 yards, mm-hmm. and so nobody can really see what's going on. Everybody's writing from their own, or drawing or whatever, from their own perspective. And then if you back up away from it, you see that there's something more going on. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so that's kind of the mystery of inspiration, that people are still retaining their agency. They're still speaking into their own context and all that. But when you get away from it, you back up and you see the bigger picture, you realize that this was all orchestrated by somebody. Mm-hmm. And so that's impressive to me.
No. So interesting that what's striking to me right now is that the mystery of inspiration is still there. It's just, it's shifted its focus. So like in the more fundamentalist reading of Genesis chapters 1 and 2, in the misconception, the mystery of inspiration is that God somehow told an ancient writer how it happened that God created the world, that an ancient writer just had this insight given directly by God. You weren't there, but I was there. Trust me. This is how it happened. Write this down.
Yeah.
That's the mystery of inspiration in the maybe a more traditional fundamentalist kind of viewpoint, right?
Right.
We're saying, no, let's be more sophisticated than that. Let's read the Bible as literature. Let's dig into let's find clues in the text that indicate to us that this is a poem and this is not history. It's things like that.
Right.
So on the one hand, we're saying, no, let's read it with more sophistication. And on the other hand, we're saying there is a mystery of inspiration that is there. However, it has more to do with the gospel.
Right, yeah. And I think that second statement that you made, it gives us the foundation to look a bit more critically at the text, to have moments when we're like, okay, well, this guy had this agenda and he's trying to promote this idea in his superficial read, you know, in the superficial reading of this. And we can acknowledge all that. We could say, well, this seems to be a later writer. He's writing back. Maybe he's attributing authorship to somebody, but he's writing on their behalf, and which was a common practice. It wasn't something that was intentionally deceptive. I'm just writing in somebody's name or on their behalf. And so you would name it for them. We could look at whatever agendas that the authors had along the way and say, okay, you know, this one seems to be writing in a way that he's making friends with the occupying power, you know, and so he's helping the Hebrews to learn how to get along, right? And maybe there's some of that in there, okay? We have to allow that if there's any sort of human participation in the way that the text is crafted, and we know that there is because there's different styles as different writers, you know, write just different idioms. We can tell one writer from another by the kind of their linguistic signature. So we know that the humans retain their agency in this process. Okay. And we know that there's a very strong human component in the canon. There were a lot of books that were up for inclusion and were rejected. So who did that? And nobody claimed some sort of direct inspiration from God in the process of canonization. So ultimately, editorial decisions were made. And those were not directly divinely dictated. So there has to be a human component. And we can be free to acknowledge that. We can be free to get involved in things like textual criticism, consideration of the context and the background and all that, while retaining the sense that it's inspired. So I would say that the Bible is a transcendent book in that it somehow mysteriously reveals things that maybe even the original authors didn't fully understand as they were writing, and they had maybe one superficial agenda, and behind that is something more.
When you say that, are you inspired by that comment Peter made? Did Peter make that comment?
Right, yeah. So he says that they, you know, they longed to look into these things, that they were moved along, you know, as the Spirit gave them utterance. And so, yeah, that to some could sound like divine dictation, but it's clearly not, because again, you hear in different voices. So different stylistic choices, linguistic choices. John, whoever wrote the Johannine corpus, I assume it was John the disciple, has very different, you could tell he's less educated in Greek than Paul, you know, Saul of Tarsus was. So, I mean, was God suddenly less educated when he gets to working through John, or is it John?
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
So those kinds of differences suggest a strong human influence in all of it. And we can admit that if we understand that there is this transcendent truth that's being worked out. It gives us a lot of freedom, I think, to be honest, to consider the text, to draw from the richness of that context, to study that, and to think about the circumstances that Israel was in for much of, you know, the Old Testament and all that. So it's important to have that freedom to look at it that way. If we don't, if we think that the Bible has to be, if we say, well, the Bible is the revelation of God, you know, we would say, oh, there's a general revelation, and that's maybe nature, right? And experience, there's a specific revelation, and that's the Bible. And those really are two kinds. And that God means to reveal himself through the Bible. And that's what we understand. That's our narrative. It does a couple of things. If we do that, we think, well, God only revealed himself to a very narrow set of people. And he did it in little doses. So revelation has, you know, specific revelation has been very sparse throughout human history. And so that's one thing that it does, is it suggests that God has favorites and that he very much limited what he really wants people to know to just a very small subset of people. The other thing that it does is it requires that we take as literal of a look at the Bible as we can, because it's telling us everything God wants us to know. And so if it begins with, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and it carries on this procedural passage, then that must be how it happened, right? Why would God go to all this trouble to reveal this blow-by-blow account of creation if that's not exactly how it happened? If God's given us a book to reveal who he is, right? Mm-hmm. Why would he do it in ways that are somewhat opaque and contradictory? You know, would any of us do that? You know, let's just say you've been given maybe a limited time to live, and you want to leave behind your legacy, mm-hmm. okay? And you want to write down what you think is the most important for your children or people who are you were influential with coming behind you.
Right, right. Would you write a story or an allegory?
Right.
Or would you just lay it out?
Some abstract poem or whatever. You know, maybe you would, but at some point you would want to be methodical, systematic, as clear as you can. You know? Especially if you're trying to pass on some technical information.
You know? Such as how I made the world.
Right. Yeah, right. Yeah. Let's say Steve Jobs, you know, he's created the iPhone and... But before he's had a chance to really release it to anybody, he finds out, you know, you're going to be dead day after tomorrow, you know. Mm-hmm. And so he's only got so much time to tell his buddy, whatever his name is, Tim Cook, yeah, what, you know, about this device he's made, right? And Tim needs to know this because the future of the company depends on it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So is he going to, you know, go into some la-di-da story about it? I don't think so, right? And so when we treat the Bible in a way that I don't think it was ever meant to be treated, then we get from it things mm-hmm. that we never were meant to receive. Mm-hmm. So
we have assumptions. Like, we come to the Bible with assumptions about what inspiration must mean, and then that determines how we interpret it.
Right.
Or we have assumptions about God and revelation, like what it would mean for God to give us a book.
Right.
And we have assumptions about what that would mean, and then that forces us to read it a certain way.
Right.
We need to revisit our assumptions, I think, is your point.
Right, right. And based on those assumptions, what people get is a very fragile faith. So that when they're confronted with other narratives, they start to wonder, you know, how much of this is really from God? Is this just one person's view on what God must want us to do? Was it written just to, as a tribal narrative, to consolidate a group of people? We begin to impugn the Bible because we start to discover things that are actually true about it and really can't logically be refuted. So, for instance, there are other creation myths around the world, mm-hmm. and while some of them may seem fantastical, in ways they're not anymore than, you know, God making a man out of dust and blowing in his nostrils or whatever.
And there
it's
are
just that we're conditioned.
Mm. Well, and yeah, and there are similarities between Gilgamesh and Genesis 1 chapter and Genesis 2. I can't remember what all those similarities are, mm-hmm. but scholars point those things out. So which reflects the argument you're making, which is that these people wrote from within their context.
Right. Yeah. Now, the creation...
And for their own purposes and agenda.
Sure.
And so on.
Now, creation narratives, I think, outside of the Bible and the, you know, the Abrahamic traditions, they do all have one thing in common that makes the Bible distinct from them. Mm-hmm. And that is that none of them presume that everything was created from nothing. Well, even the Genesis accounts don't, but as scripture continues, we get mm-hmm. this sense that, you know, God's from everlasting, that everything that is temporal, mm-hmm. that there is this creation ex nihilo that is unique as far as I'm aware, and someone can help me, but if they know of something else, but almost every creation narrative begins with pre-existing matter, You know, so there's a turtle or whatever, and we create everything on the back of it, or they're the Titans and we kill them and we use their body parts to make everything, right? So, so that we kind of enter into this story where it's already going on. Mm-hmm. And so it's really not a creation myth so much as it is how things got to be the way they are, not how everything came to be, but how things got to be the way they are. Now, Genesis 1, I think, is as close as you get in terms of, and I'm going to use the word myth, and by that I don't mean something that's mm-hmm. false. You know what
Again,
I mean?
You're using right? the language of literature.
Right. 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 And so the first creation myth of 2 in Genesis 1 and 2 is it does open on as close to nothing as you can get, right?
The earth was formless and void.
Dark, watery ball, right? Yeah. So now where that came from, we have to presume must be God, right? And as more poetic and prophetic passages come up on down the line, you know, as God's a creator of all things, then we have to assume that ball, that watery ball, came from God as well. Now, maybe that people make assumptions that, you know, there had been a creation and there was a cataclysm and, you know, we're meeting the earth at a time when it was completely covered in water, you know, and then it's the water recedes and then we do it again, right? So this may be another iteration, an age or an epoch in the history of the earth that the beginning of Genesis 1. We don't know, but these are the kind of details that we, you know, people who are very literalistic about it will gloss this over. Right. So why did that happen? You know, why does it open on a dark, watery ball? Why, you know, and what was before that? If Genesis 1 is to tell us where everything came from, why doesn't it tell us where that came from?
And that, there's our assumptions driving our interpretation.
Right.
Whereas if we can lay aside our assumptions as best as possible, we can never fully do that, but we do the best we can at that, try to look at it honestly, we might come to see, what was the phrase you used? This is not so much to tell us where everything came from, but rather to tell us how everything came to be the way it is.
Right.
More, yeah. More about the order and nature of the universe or the mm-hmm. earth.
Right.
Than its origin.
Yeah. Yeah, and every creation myth does that. I think, like I said, the Bible assumes that everything ultimately came from God and that there was nothing before he created it. Now, when and how that happened, we don't know. And the Bible doesn't tell us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know? But if you talk to any young earth creationist, they will start with creation as though there wasn't that dark ball there. They'll say, God spoke light into existence, you know, and then we'll just start with that.
Mm-hmm.
As though the light flashes on nothing, you know, maybe day 3, the earth appears in our concept. But we have to, I think it's important to acknowledge that Genesis 1 is not written to tell us where everything came from. If it were, we wouldn't open on a ball. It would have been much easier, right? Simpler. If it was written to tell us where everything came from, just to tell us in the beginning there was nothing, you know, and God spoke into the nothing and it brought forth, right?
Mm-hmm.
That would have been a better telling if you wanted to say where everything came from, but it doesn't seem to be the intent. So I guess that's why young earth creationism is flawed in that it takes this kind of high ground that, no, well, you know, we're taking the literal sense of the Bible mm-hmm. and you aren't. And I was like, are you though?
Okay.
Yeah. Right. You know,
so, cause they would say, well, you're just relying upon modern science. We rely upon the Bible.
Right.
And you're saying, no, actually, if you look at the Bible more carefully, you'll see that your argument falls apart.
Right. Right. And we've mentioned on previous, maybe 2 or 3 ago that we, you know, that Genesis 1 and 2 are clearly different stories of where everything came from, or at least how things got to be.
Mm-hmm.
Very clearly, very, not just different, but opposite, you know, in that you begin with the dark watery ball, and you end up with man in Genesis 1, and then in Genesis 2, you start with dirt, and you end up, you get a man, and then you get plants, and then you get animals, you know. And so in 1, man is the final culmination of all things, and in Genesis 2, he's the beginning. Mm-hmm. And the reason for all things.
And each of them can each make a point, even maybe in part the same point, which is to say, I think one of our points today is that these stories are intended to make theological statements.
Right.
Rather than to tell us history, like this is how it happened.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's not like they aren't related to creation, or that we don't get some sense of our origins from them, but we have to realize that they are not written to be a, you know, straightforward explanation of how or where everything came from or how creation happened. Mm-hmm. So much as to teach in broad strokes, you know, God created everything, yeah. And but even, for instance, John, in the Gospel of John, I think he's making a Christological point from the Genesis narrative about light being the beginning of all things, right? You know, this is what you've heard from the beginning, you know? So, and well, in the Gospel of John, he takes Genesis 1 and he makes the point that everything is dependent on God's word. Right. And his name is Jesus. You know, he goes on to say that there's this.
Because in Genesis 1, it says, and God said.
Right.
And God said, let there be. And God said, let there be. And so right. John's picking up on that.
Right. Yeah. So he's taking that, but he's looking at Genesis 1. And in there, he finds Christ, who is, as in his understanding, the expression of God. Right. He is the revelation of God, the image of God. All of these things are there in the beginning. This light, this image in Adam, right? And so in that, John sees, he sees Christ. So already, and we could say, well, you know, we've only started to see this. We've only taken a Christological approach to Genesis 1 and 2 because of Darwin. It's like, that's not true, right? You know, did John the Apostle know Charles Darwin, right? He obviously didn't. And yet he's saying, look, this passage isn't so much about creation as it is about a pretelling of God's revelation through his son. You know, and so he's saying, this is what we've heard from the beginning. You know, the Word was with God. The Word was God. In him was life, and that life was the light of humankind. So there's this glory of God, this expression of God that everything is made for. It's kind of the purpose of all things, okay? So, and it is embodied in this one who became Jesus of Nazareth and is now embodied in us, who he's, you know, John goes on to say, we've beheld his glory, and we have received from it, you know. So Paul seems to see things in very much the same way, where he says, he who declared, let there be light, has shown in our hearts the glory of Christ, you know. And so we, you know, we go out and we declare this gospel that is the light, right? That life comes in the wake of light. Well, we know that, right? We know that light is critical for existence. John seems to build a lot of his works on the creation narratives. So, you know, you get in 1 John, it seems to track all the way through Genesis 4, where he gets down to 1 John 3, and he says, this is what we've heard, that, you know, if anyone hates their brother, they're a murderer. You know, so he's all the way down into Cain and Abel. So John is taking a look at Genesis 1 through 4, and he's saying God has been preaching to us the gospel the whole time. And this is what that is. So we were talking on Sunday, and we've said on this podcast that, you know, Jesus is not the solution to Adam's problem. Adam is the problem to Jesus' solution. So that once we've encountered the gospel, then Adam, the story about Adam, becomes a preparation for redemption through one individual. Right? The story of Adam is crafted as the downfall of humankind through one individual. That's really what it's where it's getting us, right? That's the, if you were critiquing it as a story arc, that's the lead. From the time Adam is created, there are two trees. You know, this isn't just some afterthought. We're not telling some long narrative about the paradisic experience of Adam and Eve in the garden. Everything is bringing us to that moment of eating the fruit, really. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, it's all set up from the time mm-hmm. Adam's created. Mm-hmm. So that Paul would say that things were constructed in that way. And so there has to be a level of historicity to it. But it's the point of it isn't so much to tell us where we came from, but how we got to needing redemption. Mm-hmm. And so... Mm-hmm.
Yeah, when I took an Old Testament class a long time ago, they introduced a concept of etiology. That was the sort of scientific word for what you just said. Etiology is like the study of a story or piece of literature through the lens of the question, how is this answering the question, how did things come to be the way they are?
Yeah.
So these ancient myths are there to tell us answers to worldview questions. Mm-hmm. How did things come to be the way they are?
Right. Exactly. And, you know, the scope in these passages is very narrow. Right. And so, and we have to take into account that, yes, this is a document written to a small subset of humankind. And it talks about things that happen within a region. You know, the word earth or whatever is used, but that word can mean the land, right? It can refer to a region as well as to the globe, and whether, you know, anybody had a concept that there was a globe at all probably is tenuous at best. So, you know, when they speak of the, you know, Eretz, it can mean a region, it can mean the whole globe, you know, all the earth, or dirt, right? Mm-hmm. It can mean lots of different things. So it seems, for instance, when you get to, and we talked about Cain, right? And he moves east, and there's an assumption that there are people out there that we're not explaining where they came from or anything else. Now, if you're a young earth creationist, you have to fill in the gaps, right? And come up with, like, he married his sisters, and somehow Adam and Eve had all kinds of progeny that we're not told about, and they're out there. But that's no more substantiated than anything else. That's taking a leap, and again, it's following a set of assumptions. But and that's what's troubling is that people who do that claim this high ground in terms of interpretive honesty, mm-hmm. And it's clearly a dishonest practice. So I don't think that should be left unanswered. You know, I kind of almost feel like you have people who are on one side who are very literalist, fundamentalist like this, who are saying, well, we're taking the Bible for face value. And then you have people on the other side who are more liberal, and they're like, well, you really can't do that because science has proven this and all that. And so there's nobody who's actually defending the Bible. You only have people who are defending an approach to the Bible, and you have people who are kind of taking it apart. And so I would say that the gospel gives us the power and the ability to defend the Bible, to say, well, no, it does say this, and you know, you have to wrestle with that. You have to acknowledge that whoever wrote this is bringing up the fact that there are people outside of this paradisic realm, and they were apparently there before Adam was created, you know, and that they are to be feared, that they don't have the same sense of the existence of God or experience with him that whoever was in this one small region had. So why is that? You know, and if we can wrestle with that and get to this kind of Christological, because That, to me, that's the only assumption that always is upheld. And maybe it's because of my confirmation bias.
Wait, what assumption is always upheld?
That it is pointing to Jesus. Hmm. So, if you look at, I mean, we can take any one of the narratives and stories, and you know, but what you find is that there is, like John found with this Christological approach to Genesis 1, you can find Christological approach to Genesis 2, as we've talked about one flesh and the importance of really God being wed to his creation, humankind, that being the kind of fertile union that brings forth the multiplication of the divine image. So in every case, you can find that there's a kind of a clear connection, and it could be that just whoever is writing the New Testament is looking at the old and unpacking it. But there are times when there are obvious Christological material in the Old Testament that is not made explicit in the New. It's almost like there's so much Christological material in the Old Testament that the New Testament wasn't big enough to fit it. Mm-hmm. You know, somehow Paul preached all night from the Old Testament, right? Mm-hmm. About Jesus. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot to be said that we don't have the benefit of encountering in the New Testament, just because it's like a sampling. It's like, mm-hmm, the such like, you know. So, for instance, the author of Hebrews, as he's writing along, you know, he's saying, you know, we could say more about this, but we can't because of time. So we're going to move on. Mm-hmm. And you're like, wait, what are you not saying?
Right.
You know, and so like he brings up Melchizedek, and he talks about how Melchizedek is a king of righteousness, which is the meaning of his name. He's the king of Salem, which is the king of peace. You know, he's the king of what was he? I think he was the early king of Jerusalem, Jebusite king or whatever. But, you know, that he's got, there's all these things about him that are pointing to a Davidic Messiah before David was born, right? Before Moses was born, before Levi was born, according to the author of Hebrews. Why does this character come up? You know, he's just a sidebar character. Mm-hmm. And yet he's brought up, he's got these accolades and, you know, all these bona fides. He's contrasted with the king of Sodom, who Abraham won't have anything to do with, right? So that all seems to be for something, but that doesn't really contribute to the arc, Abraham's story arc. Mm-hmm. It's a parenthetical. Mm-hmm. Author of Hebrews seems to see something Christological in that, mm-hmm, okay? And then later, Melchizedek's brought up in Psalm 110, you know, because how do you cross the streams between king and priest? Does God break his own law, violate his own rules, knock down a partition that he built? Or has God left the door open for a priest king, even though from that moment on, he has drawn the clear line, right? Mm-hmm. So you can't, I mean, the whole Levitical system, you're not going to get a king from that system. So, you know, the Levites have to have the priesthood. Later, tribe of Judah has to have the kingly office, and so now they're completely separate. They have to be, but God seems to have kept them separate until that time as well. But we're introduced early to somebody who violates that partition,
and is himself the union of priest and king.
Right.
Okay. That's right. Melchizedek.
He violates that, but he's also somebody who is laudable. Somebody who I guess almost receives some worship in the sense that Abraham, you know, so the king of Sodom makes an offer to Abraham and says, you know, you take all the goods and I'll keep the people, right? Mm-hmm. And Abraham says, I wouldn't even take a sandal strap from you. So Abraham's view of Abram at that time's view of the king of Sodom is so low, he wouldn't even accept a gift from him. Mm-hmm. By way of contrast, Melchizedek, Abraham gives a tenth of the spoils too. Mm-hmm. So it's a vastly different approach, right? Melchizedek blesses Abram, and as the Hebrew author says, you know, the lesser is blessed by the greater. Mm-hmm. So Abram seems to, even in this narrative about the father of their race, Israel is acknowledging somebody greater out there. Mm-hmm. You know, who is this guy? He just comes out of nowhere, mm-hmm. right? And so the author of Hebrews is like, why would that be there? And I have to ask that question with him. You know what? Where does that come from? Why is that there?
So the author of Hebrews is using the gospel as the code key, as you say,
right?
To understand the meaning of that story.
Right, right. And the Melchizedek story is kept alive. The anticipation, the waiting for someone to come in the order of Melchizedek is kept alive in Psalm 110. It's not just that the author of Hebrews is reaching way, way back to Genesis, but that there's a breadcrumb trail that he's following, you know. So where in Psalm 110, there's this kind of adulation of a great king, and you are a priest forever in the order of Melchizedek. And so there's this there's this eternal priesthood, there's Melchizedek, but it is to a king, you know. Mm-hmm. So there's this waiting for
an king.
Eternal king who is a priest, right? Mm-hmm. So the author of Hebrews makes all that point, but he leaves out something that is, to me, is low-hanging fruit in the Melchizedek story. So Melchizedek is a part of this celebration. You know, Abram has conquered these kings. He's recaptured Lot and his family and all that, right? And so there's a victory celebration, and Melchizedek brings forth some food. Now, what, you know, what might he bring to this feast? You know, could be lots of things, right? It could be the choicest cattle, could be a hull of fish or whatever that people would want. But he brings forth bread and wine. Mm-hmm. You know, the author of Hebrews doesn't even bother to talk about that, doesn't bring it up. Mm-hmm. But it's clear, there's a clear Christological connection, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, oh my goodness. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think we can't fully appreciate how important the Lord's Supper or Eucharist was to the retention of the gospel message. Mm-hmm. You know, this is,
and it has roots as far back as Melchizedek.
Right. I mean, it's screaming Jesus, right? this gift of bread and wine, it's just screaming Jesus all over it. But the author of Hebrews doesn't bother to bring it up. Nobody brings it up. Nobody talks about it. You know. Which goes to say that there are things, and we've mentioned others, that in the Old Testament narrative that are clearly Christological, that now again, we tend to make patterns out of things and look back and see ambiguous stuff in ways that we want to see them, like looking at clouds and seeing a rabbit, right? Mm-hmm. But I submit this, you know, just have two elements, right? You know, it's not like there's some vast array of elements, and among them is bread and wine. You know, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you don't have to agree with me. Mm-hmm. That's fine. But I could bring up lots and lots of other things where there's something that comes in to the narrative that doesn't have a purpose in storytelling. It's something that maybe is just a sidebar, or it's something that doesn't fit what you think the agenda is. And it points to him. Mm-hmm.
And that's the mystery of inspiration as you see it. This is how God is working mysteriously in the human author writing from his or her own context for his or her own agenda and purposes, nevertheless pointing to Christ.
Right. So let me get back to the idea of creation. I said young earth creationism is I don't want to pick on it. I mean, I know that people are well-intentioned, but I think that what they do is that they lampoon the Christian system to some degree because they create this fantastical narrative, you know, of children riding dinosaurs and stuff. Maybe that happened. That's fine. But it creates a layer of credulity that people have in order to accept the gospel then. Mm-hmm. And that's a challenge. Now, if we later find, you know, dinosaur saddles out there or something, in the archaeological digs or something, then we'll be like, man, that was awesome. That'd be cool. I can't wait to ride a dinosaur when God remakes creation or whatever, you know, that's fine. That's good. I don't care. But I think it calls on people to believe something that we shouldn't be forced to believe mm-hmm. in order to accept Jesus. Mm-hmm. So that's a difficulty, and it does that because they're following this set of assumptions that leads them to a very rigid and really unlikely version of events, mm-hmm. you know, and so people are in this dilemma of, hey, believe this kind of whack, you know, totally left, you know, coming out of left field narrative or get out.
Yeah. In their version of Christianity, belief in Jesus as Lord entails belief in the Bible as the literal mm-hmm. word of God. So everything that's in the Bible is to be taken literally. Mm-hmm. That just goes hand in hand with believing Jesus is Lord.
Right. Which, you know, like if we have to believe then that the earth is young, well, the Bible doesn't teach that. Remember, we said it opens on the earth already here. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So clearly the Bible doesn't teach that the earth is young, even if those are 24, you know, literal 24-hour periods, seven 24-hour periods, then, but we do know that the earth is much, much, or at least a day older, a few moments older, however old it is, but we're not told when it came around. Mm-hmm. So young earth creationism is unbiblical at the outset mm-hmm. because it doesn't acknowledge that the earth was already there.
Mm-hmm. Nor does it acknowledge that the 6 days of creation don't make sense taken scientifically or historically. Like you have light before the creation of the sun and things like that. And so you look into the text more carefully and you see, and this looks more like a poem about creation, mm-hmm. maybe there to tell us important truths about God and creation.
Right.
Not so much to tell us how it happened.
Yeah. Exactly. And I have a feeling that it is, you know, it is a bookmark for Christ, that it seems to me that the church understood that creation week had ended with the resurrection of Christ, and now we're in new creation week, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. which is why the church met on the first day of the week as opposed to the seventh. Mm-hmm. So if there are any Seventh-day Adventists out there, that the meeting on Saturday for the Jews was this reminder and this commemoration of creation. Mm-hmm. But the church seemed to see a new day dawning mm-hmm. with the resurrection of Christ. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Paul calls Jesus the second Adam and all that. And for them, I think that day one, it was important. And so Paul says, we're going around shouting, let there be light.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I remember N.T. Wright pointing out in the Gospel of John, he says at the end of the Gospel, he says, at dawn on the first day of the week.
Yeah.
When the resurrection, the appearances.
Right,
The account of the appearances of Jesus risen begins with, at dawn on the first day of the week, which seems to be John's way of alluding to this is new creation.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, what's coming? I don't know. Mm-hmm. Do we find that the sky's going to split? You know, do we find that, you know, the earth's going to be remade, renewed? Peter suggests that it's in fire, but that there's a scrubbing of everything with, presumably the inbreaking of new life. You know, are there eras and epochs that are coming with the return of Christ that will follow similarly that outline, but will perhaps take ages? Like, there's an old earth creation guy named Hugh Ross, who's written a lot about Yom, the word for day, as an era or an epic. He was, I would say he was an atheist. He was just raised without Christianity, you know, and was studying astrophysics and stuff, and really came to faith by reading the Genesis 1 narrative. So he kind of he believed in the Bible through Genesis 1, even though he was like an astrophysicist. But he did because that outline followed generally a very old earth view of how things came to be. you know, that there would be at one point that the earth was covered in a shroud of gases to so that light couldn't touch the surface of the earth, you know. That shroud of gases would need to be moved out of the way or, you know, somehow settled and for light to touch the earth. And so that would have atmospheric implications. And so the atmosphere is going to have to change. Day two, you know, there's going to have to be some sort of plant life developing first in the oceans and then on the ground, you know, on the land. You know, you can't really grow plants unless there are already dead plants in the dirt. And so there had to have been aquatic plants, and then those had to enrich the earth, and then the earth is able to grow, you know, seed-bearing plants and other things on the face of the earth. So, you know, if you look at just the methodical nature of creation and that one thing must precede another, he was impressed by that. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's the intention, okay? Maybe that's some of it. But again, you have multi-layers here. At the same time, I think on a spiritual level that the new earth is coming about, maybe in following a similar outline. And at least that's how the New Testament authors saw it. And because they saw that we are in the era of let there be light, it suggests that they did not see those days as literal 24-hour periods. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That Israel saw, you notice at the end of day seven, or that there is no end of day seven. In Genesis 1 and the early part of 2, you know, there is this refrain throughout, and there was morning and evening, or evening and morning, a single day. Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You don't get that at the end.
On the seventh day, God rested. It doesn't say that again, does it?
Right. So, you know, there's this, I think there was this understanding that we're not going to expect new species to pop up on the planet in this era, you know, in the Anthropocene era. We're not going to expect a whole lot of new species to pop up, which has been the case, right? And it says on the seventh day, God finished his work he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work he had done. So God blessed the seventh day, made it holy. So Hugh Ross would suggest that we've been in the seventh day. If that's true, and that seems to be what the narrative's saying, then, you know, the days are implicitly not 24-hour periods. That's clear. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. So,
well, that's kind of an old Earth version of interpreting it literally,
right?
Kind of like let's take it as an account of history, from an old Earth point of view.
Right.
And so I'm not sure I'm buying that, but I find that interesting because I'm more interested in seeing it in its literary, from its literary standpoint. Like, this is a poem. This is here to tell us something about God and humanity.
Right.
Something about the nature of God, something about the nature of humanity, not here to tell us history. This, he seems to be coming at it from, like, he's still looking for history in Genesis 1. Mm-hmm. It's interesting nevertheless. But I think it's interesting that We have young Earth creationism, literalism on the one hand, insisting on a certain view, literal view of the Bible. On the other hand, we have your typical Old Testament scholars, the field of Old Testament scholarship, insisting on interpreting it as literature, and also at the same time insisting on not interpreting it from the lens of the gospel.
Right.
And so the Old Testament scholarship is more carefully looking at the text as literature, and it's picking up on things.
Right.
Bits and pieces and cultural background and all of that. Does a better job, far better job, than the literalist point of view, the Christian literalist point of view. But it fails to see the, and it really insists on not seeing.
Right, yeah.
The hints at Christ.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. He's precluded at the outset, right, I think, for them.
And so they're closing themselves off to inspiration in that way.
Sure. Well, and we also have to be careful, because the Bible is a multi-layered book, we have to be careful that not to fall victim to kind of this false dichotomy, either or. Mm-hmm. You know, I think there are clearly historical components in the Bible that, while not perhaps intentioned to to give us, you know, clear blow by blow, but to be more of an impressionist sense of broad stroke. Mm-hmm. You know, I do think there was some cataclysmic flood mm-hmm. around, right? I do think that...
And maybe that's why there's multiple accounts from the ancient world about mm-hmm. a flood. I think it was, I said Gilgamesh earlier, maybe right. it was Enuma Elish, that maybe that's the flood uh-huh. story. But there's other flood yeah. stories from the ancient
Gilgamesh,
world.
Definitely famous flood story. In that one, God's just, everybody's too loud and he decides to kill us all. But uh-huh. At any rate, you know, but they claim there are over 200 flood myths throughout the world. I don't really know what those are, and I'm just passing on third-hand information. But there are a lot of flood myths mm-hmm. Around. Probably that region is the cradle of civilization, it seems like, you know. So this, whatever God did, if you know, if the Adam story has however much historicity involved, that there does seem to be this moment when God intersected with humankind. There's this awakening of humanity from, you know, predator, hunter-gatherer kind of, you know, thing to somebody who's producing culture and art and other things. So there's something that's happened there. There's a kind of people living at one level outside of that area, and people who are living at a higher level on the inside of it. You know, there's something going on, I think, historically. But again, it's broad strokes, and it doesn't have to be exactly literal mm-hmm. to carry the intention mm-hmm. of this narrative. So, I mean, I would think the way I see it is that Genesis 1 is poetry, and it's teaching us theology. I do think that there's at least some sort of correlation to way things happened, mm-hmm. but it doesn't have to be. We don't have to just make it fit.
Right.
You know, so.
Guys, that was a good talk. We're going to just come to a hard landing right there. We just could go on and on. But if you yeah. have questions, you can email us. discussion@recoverfaith.org. Thanks, and we'll see you next time.